Our dear friend and colleague Paul Elisha has died. He was 92. Paul was an inspiration, a mentor, and confidant. He was filled with wit, passion, integrity, and an understanding of what made us better people. There was music and poetry that he dispensed with such beauty and candor. Paul has been a part of the Roundtable since its inception. He was a frequent commentator. He hosted our longtime performance play segment and would regularly interview noted poets for his Bard's Eye View segment. In remembrance of Paul this morning, we wanted to play two of his personal favorites. The first is with William J. Smith, the former poetry consultant to the Library of Congress.
William J. Smith has graced these microphones several times in recent years. I use the term grace with deliberate intent, because more than any other, it's a quality he consistently brings. Bill Smith was an American poet laureate before there was such a designation. From 1968 to 1970, he was consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. He's authored a dozen major books of poetry and half again as many works in translation, plus numerous criticisms and memoirs. It was only a year or two ago that we discovered we'd spent most of World War II shadowing each other's paths across the Pacific, sometimes only a stone's throw apart. Bill, welcome back. And for starters, this question: why did it take so long for this particular poetic memoir to emerge?
Well, I suppose that this is what happens, and with age you start reliving your life, and this is what happened, because I felt when I got to this particular island where I was sent by the Navy, my first assignment to this island of Palmyra, which is 1,000 miles southwest of Honolulu.
Actually, 1,000 miles from anywhere.
Well, exactly. It's almost the exact center of the Pacific Ocean, mm-hmm. and it's certainly miles from anything. I really realized where I was, and although I had published poems in little magazines and even nationally, it was here that I felt that my career as a poet began, because I was there where there was nothing else to do except look at the ocean and perhaps listen to myself reading my own poems.
Now, we've talked of your many published volumes of poetry, but I'd like to now focus on this latest effort, Words by the Water, just coming out from Johns Hopkins University Press. There have been many descriptions of island warfare in the Pacific, but there's another aspect of the remoteness and isolation felt by those who serve there. And I wonder if you'd talk a bit about this. And also, there are two poems particularly that I think truly emphasize it. And I wonder if after this you could read them for us, both of them.
The section of the book, I call it the Atoll, because it was written about this island on which I served for 4 months. Then I went afterwards shipboard later, and I was on many, many other islands, as you were.
Yes.
But I
some of them almost together.
Almost together, but I because we were very slow on the ship that I was on, we were left behind while you went on into battle. I'm afraid that I was lagging behind, and you were the real person up in front. But in any case, I had decided that I had written several poems while I was actually on this island of Palmyra, and I would start with them, and then I wrote others remembering that experience of being on that island. I wrote them, and so I'll read your first one is Of Islands, which I wrote when I was there, and then I'll read the other one, which I wrote afterwards. I recently, actually.
In retrospect.
We're thinking of it. So this one is called Of Islands. Of all the islands sailing down the west, of islands sailing north and south and east, It is not islands you remember best, or better, have forgotten least. It is not land, the quick, sure touch of trees, not all the lusty continent which sense reveals, which floats upon the mind immense with ease and steals away as quick as darkness steals. It is not islands. It is less than islands. Land still land until at once you see you have come upon a calm enclosed lagoon and earth in its entirety. And since it is an interim of sea and air, even as islands ultimately are, and the waves are clouds which crawl back up the sky to overtake a star, then even if the land is land no man can mend, which salt nor sand nor star can clean, this is the island which our lives defend, where life must end and death put forth its green.
The way you've crafted it, it has a starkness that is very reminiscent of some of those islands themselves.
Well, it's odd that actually when I wrote this, I wrote it almost as if I had been to every island in the Pacific. I hadn't been, because I had been to... I'd been the first time I'd left Mississippi, the edge of the Mississippi where I grew up, was to go to France in 1938 to study. And there I saw my first islands, of course. But this, actually, when I went here, I felt that I was seeing all of those islands, and in a sense, I saw many of them later. But this was written right there, and I think you're right about the feeling that it is. I tried to get the feeling of being absolutely off by myself. In fact, I wrote as in this book, I wrote a little note to that poem. Because I say that the poem that we the place I was going to defend was Palmyra, and I was there when there were very few troops, It became afterwards an important a station for planes going south in the Navy, but then there was very, 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 very few people there. And then I wrote this little note about the feeling of being there. It was at night on Palmyra, with water on every side and the phosphorescent breakers of that vast ocean pounding the reef and the Southern Cross above at my fingertips, that I came to know the terrifying beauty of being at what seemed then the edge of this earth.
Hmm. Now, I think some of that comes out in the other poem, too, the Atoll.
Yes, well, this is a poem that I wrote, actually just a few years ago when I was thinking about reliving this whole thing. And I remembered that in my head, when I was on the island, I had started it, and the start of it was the opening lines, "An island is all one can ever know and all it can ever be," you know, which is absolutely the opposite of what John Donne says, and that is that no man is an island.
Right.
You know, but this... In a sense, I mean that this is everybody is separate from everything else, but we all must join in a union. And in this case, I think what I was writing, as you'll see, I think is the fact that it is the artist, the poet, must make a bridge to the world.
The poet is the connection.
The poetry and art is the connection.
Right.
And that's what I say in this poem. I'll read it to you now. "An island is all one can ever know and all that can ever be, though part of a vast archipelago rooted in the sea. It is all one feels, all one finds, all that the heart lays bare. An atoll formed, the waking minds open on endless air." Now, I meant by this is the island that comes back to you when you wake up in the morning, and it is as if you're open on the whole world, and that's what it seems to me art is all about.
It's a wonderful poem, and it says so much. And again, the name of this book, "Words by the Water," William J. Smith, It's a pleasure to have had you. It always is, Bill.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here, and I must say that I've had a wonderful response when I've given readings before. I think it shows how many people do listen to WAMC, and particularly to you.
Paul Elisha speaking with William J. Smith on A Bard's Eye View. Another one of Paul's favorites as we remember Paul this morning is when he spoke with friend and poet Joel Marbrook.
Our guest on A Bard's Eye View today is really more than a guest now. He's become a friend. Joel Marbrook, who has a wonderful new book out, Brushstrokes and Glances, a book of poems, and it's published by Deerbrook Editions. And for me, it was a revelation, in a way. You, Joel, have literally poured so much of yourself into this volume. What was it that you set out to achieve in the reader via the often tenuous or metaphorical connection between these two art forms? And I will begin by telling you that while I'm a great appreciator of art, and we have many pieces in our home, etc., I can't tell you from a technical point of view why I like them. As a youngster, the best I could do were stick figures. So that will give you sort of a background. But I have a deep love of great art when I see it. But you have made such an effort, really. And I see it as an effort of many years to make a connection between these two art forms.
It is a project, maybe perhaps even a lifelong project. I had an early exposure to the French surrealist poets, because when the poets and the artists fled Europe because of the Nazi advance, many of them came to New York. And my mother, an artist, was hanging out with André Breton and many of the French surrealists. And of course, by that time, I was a young teenager, and I had already read Baudelaire and Rimbaud. So I kind of related to the roots of the surrealist poets movement. And because the surrealists were so influential in the art world and so influential on certain artists, I just grew up thinking that there was an intricate relationship between painting and poetry. I don't know that I included sculpture in my thinking at that point. And this book was a revelation for me. It was kind of a spiritual journey, because I was trying to understand my own feelings about paintings, and I realized I rather much regard my life as witness to the beauty that I see, witness to the paintings. And I think probably that's why I also indulge in a lot of photography. But the final revelation for me in doing this, putting together this book, was that I saw as a poet, for some reason, I don't know how it came to me, that I'm here to pay homage to this beauty, but I'm not here to be recognized for having paid homage to this beauty. I'm here to see, but I'm not here to be seen. And that to me was startling and life-changing, because, you know, writers spend a great deal of their lives, well, trying to get their work published, and then when it's published, trying to get it reviewed and promoting it and marketing it. And this book and also my own photography just convinced me that that I'm here as a witness. I'm here to testify to this beauty that I see. And that's what most of these poems are about. Sometimes I talk to the paintings. Sometimes they talk to me.
Well, it's interesting that you have gone off on that tack, because I came across an interesting quote by T.S. Eliot on art, in which he says, "The only way of expressing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative, a set of objects, a situation, a chain of events, to be a formula of that particular emotion."
You know, I'm quite familiar with that quote by Eliot, and I think art lovers are quite familiar with it. And immediately when I read it, and I don't know at what point in my life I did read it, I thought of Cézanne and the relationship between the bare canvas in Cézanne and silence in poetry and in music. I mean, without silence, there is no poetry
or
music.
The spaces between.
Exactly. The interstices, so to speak. And that's what struck Braque and Picasso when they saw their first Cézanne in a window, was not only the bare canvas, of course, but the interstices between these cubist configurations. Sometimes I think of them as the cracks between the worlds or the cracks between dimensions.
I wonder if there might be a poem in this book that sort of reflects what it is you're talking about now.
Here's a poem where I do talk about bare canvas.
Uh-huh.
And of course, when we think of bare canvas, we usually think of Cézanne. It's called "Wishing Someone Gone." When I read it at readings, I see a lot of eyebrows raise. Shall I read it, Paul?
Please.
"I'm not sure how well a life can be lived celebrating the absence of another, but it can make for a hell of a party. The case for silence is very strong, so absence can be argued as bare canvas. But if not pentimento, there's at least the memory of paint. Knowing how little one will be missed is probably easier than finding out you needed to keep on wishing someone gone. Absence and presence is all one thing, the danse macabre of canvas and paint, of silence and its carnival interruptions." It's really Cézanne who got me to thinking as a poet about the importance of silence and about how primitive words are and even language. You know, Proust, I think, was the one who said that all language is a nostalgia. It's a kind of homesickness, you know. I sort of think, I mean, this is a metaphysical idea, but I sort of think that we came here speaking a common language, a lingua franca of atoms, and that what we think of as language rather much gets in the way. And so the job of the poet is always to be cautious about the flotsam and jetsam, the debris, to get rid of it.
I think it's important for us to remember that the poet is also a messenger of the changes that are taking place around him or her and how that affects the language. Or
yes,
sometimes how the language affects the changes. And as a former musician, I am very much concerned about the rhythm of a poem. And sometimes that gets in the way of the language, too.
It does. You know, take Swinburne. You can get drunk on Swinburne before you even know what he's talking about.
Exactly.
That's right.
There are so many poems in Brushstrokes and Glances, and I did have one final question that I wanted to ask. I found something by a poet that I think both of us think a great deal of, and that's Richard Wilbur.
Oh, yes.
And I just happened to come across this. Wilbur has always been conscious that his particular poetic gifts, accurate vision, copious eloquence, spiritual resonance, and his great subject, the richness and adequacy of the natural world, were untimely. Indeed, he started writing, as he later recalled, quote, for earnest therapeutic reasons during World War II, in an effort to bring the sanity of art to bear on a personal and an objective world in disorder.
That's what I think of museums. They restore my sanity.
And I wondered if there might not be a short poem that might reflect something like that.
Perhaps. I'll read you two stanzas from a poem. This is a poem from a sequence in this book called Manhattan Reef, in which you and I have talked about this, about a vision of Manhattan underwater.
Which took place.
Which then actually happened.
Before Sandy.
Yes, it took place before the hurricane.
Yes.
I can Bruegel one Sunday afternoon, El Greco for a moment, Van Gogh till I beg for darkness, but museums suggest we're from different stars and have only a short time to visit. That's just a stanza.
But it's a powerful stanza.
I don't know why I had that vision of man, but I know when it happened. I was walking along 34th Street, and I looked up to the Needle Empire State Building, and I envisioned a dirigible anchored to it. And then I said to myself, well, of course, that's what's going to happen when Manhattan's underwater. Ships will moor themselves to the tops of skyscrapers, you know.
I could go on forever, but we can't. And the name of this marvelous book is Brush Strokes and Glances by Jalul Marbrook. Do yourself a favor and get a copy.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me. I love talking to you.
As always, a pleasure.
Paul Elisha speaking with poet Jalul Marbrook. Paul Elisha passed away on Sunday at 92. We will further remember Paul in our 11 o'clock hour when we hear a special interview he did with Dr. Alan Chartok in 2004. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.